Good morning. Welcome, everyone. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. Well, our subject today falls into one of two categories that I tend to talk about. Often I have completely unknown people who I had never even heard of till I came across them randomly, but then I have some who are almost too well known, and it's a little harder because there's a lot written about them. Emma Goldman is a subject of multiple biographies. She wrote her own memoirs, extensive ones, and many essays and letters and editorials. There's a PBS, what is that called? American Experience, I think, like hour-long documentary that the Madison Libraries have about her. Her career spanned from her early 20s till her death at 70, from the Haymarket riots through the first Red Scare, disillusionment with the USSR, and fighting in Spain. She fought for workers' rights, women's rights, birth control, educational reforms, and freedom of speech. She opposed World War I and conscription. Her end goal was always elimination of government and religious control over the individual. She proudly declared herself an anarchist. If any of you have ever looked up the records of your ancestors coming through Ellis Island, some of them have a little check mark thing, anarchist, yes or no, as if the anarchist would declare that, right? Because the government asked them to. That would be sort of like putting down that you're a terrorist now. But just like in every movement, there was a range of views. Some anarchists felt that violence was permissible and even necessary, and others weren't sure. And this happens too, right? We have this in the Black Power movement, in groups like SDS that were originally peacefully demonstrating against the war, and then you had group people that felt more direct action was needed. And they were contradictory, that on the one hand, they could be very callous. Well, people might have to die, either us or the opponents. On the other hand, they were incredibly naive. They claimed anarchy would not be the same as chaos. They believed that if all government were abolished, people would naturally organize themselves into small groups with joint goals, such as work groups or neighborhoods. And they thought that people would naturally cooperate and share their talents and resources with each other. My reaction, although I tend to be have a lot of faith in human nature, I still felt like asking them, have you ever met any people? The only examples I could think of, maybe early Christian groups that were very small, or a group like the Amish might be able to make this work. Some of us remember the 1970s when we or friends of ours went off to communes with high ideals, and they rarely lasted because of jealousy, competition, division of labor. So yes, Emma Goldman did moderate her stance over the years, as we'll see. She didn't start out as someone destined to make a worldwide impression. She was born to a poor Jewish family in Russia in the era of the pogrom. So you think of Fiddler on the Roof. She knew only want and brutality. Her father never forgave her for not being a boy, and he regularly punished her, beat her, but she did not from this learn, like some children, to be very quiet and obedient. She was constantly questioning authority and fighting back from an early age. She was also intelligent. At age 8, she was sent to her grandmother across the border in Germany, where schools were better. But 1 month later, her grandmother died, and her uncle, who was now running the house, pulled her out of school and turned her into an unpaid servant. She was a real-life Cinderella, scrubbing floors, washing clothes, cooking, running errands, and she was 8 years old. At the end of one exhausting day, the uncle ordered Emma to deliver a package several miles away. When she refused, he kicked her, knocking her down a flight of stairs. A family member informed Emma's father. He hurried over there, and she was terrified because, in her experience, her father was just as bad. But in this case, he actually seemed to care about her, took her back to Russia. But a few months later, when he lost his job, they all moved near the other family in Germany, and Emma was able to continue her education. She would have qualified for the tough entrance exam to the special high school, but she needed one more thing, a certificate of good character from her religion teacher. Emma's family wasn't particularly religious, and she despised that particular teacher, who was cruel and hypocritical. She was already an organizer. She got her classmates to play pranks on him, like placing tacks on his chair and snails in his pockets. So when it came time for her to get a certificate of good conduct from him, he declared, "I will never recommend your character. You have none." And he prophesied she would end on the public gallows. Always searching for opportunity, the family moved to St. Petersburg, so Emma was able to continue her studies there in a different school. Also, at this time in 1880s Tsarist Russia, political unrest was brewing. When she was 15, Emma's father decided on an easy way to remove this difficult teenager from the household. She was of an age to be married. Her father was legally allowed to force her to marry a man that he chose. She was so against it that she threatened to commit suicide. Her father backed down, especially when Emma's sister, Helena, who was about to immigrate to America with her husband, agreed to pay Emma's fare. So those three arrived in New York just months after the Statue of Liberty was installed. In Russia, Emma had worked as a glove maker and knitter of shawls. In Rochester, New York, she was hired at a coat factory. The women were driven to work long hours in terrible conditions for little pay. Emma felt this was hardly an improvement over Russia. She met a young man named Jacob Kirshner, who was also from Russia. She didn't particularly want to wed, but she saw little alternative. At least she felt they had something in common, and she got married when she was 17. The marriage was a disaster. Jacob had no interest in books, music, and the arts, which she loved, and apparently their sexual life was unsatisfying. She insisted on a divorce, which was a radical thing to do, and her sister was able to help her obtain one. She declared, "If I ever love a man again, I will give myself to him without being bound by the rabbi or the law. And when that love dies, I will leave without permission." Meanwhile, she underwent a revelation that would direct her life. Workers' unions around the country at this time were demanding reforms such as the eight-hour day. When they went on strike in Chicago, police brutalized and shot into the crowds. So the next day, hundreds of people gathered peacefully in Haymarket Square to protest this. When police arrived and shooting started, the city blamed anarchists. Seven of them were condemned to be hanged. Emma wrote, "I had a distinct sensation that something new and wonderful had been born in my soul, a great ideal, a burning faith, a determination to dedicate myself to the Haymarket martyrs, to make their cause my own." So at the age of 20, Emma arrived in New York City. She had an acquaintance there who took her to Saks Cafe on the Lower East Side. This was the place for radicals to meet. She made the acquaintance of Alexander Berkman, called Sasha, a young Russian with the same ideals as hers. He was to become her partner in organizing, in business, and for a long time in romance. And he introduced her to Johann Most, publisher of an anarchist paper called Die Freiheit, a word known to all the folks here, freedom. So this Johann Most decided that Emma would be a good speaker to Russian and German immigrants. She didn't speak English that well yet, but there were plenty of immigrants. So he had her memorize his speeches. When she got up to speak for the first time, she later reported, "My mind was blank. I could not remember a single word of my notes. I shut my eyes for an instant, then something strange happened. In a flash, I saw it. Every incident of my 3 years in Rochester, its drudgery and humiliation, the failure of my marriage, the Chicago crime, I began to speak. Words I had never heard myself utter before came pouring forth faster and faster. They came with passionate intensity. They painted images of the heroic men on the gallows, their glowing vision of an ideal life, rich with comfort and beauty." The audience had vanished. The hall itself had disappeared. I was conscious only of my own words, of my ecstatic song. I stopped. Tumultuous applause rolled over me. So apparently, people reported this throughout her life, what a dynamic and inspiring speaker she was. But suddenly, after the speech, she realized she hadn't talked about the specific points that she was supposed to. And when she returned to New York, Johann Most was uninterested in her newfound confidence. He wanted her only to be his subordinate. She said his Blondkopf, little girl woman, I flared up. That was her, how she said, she described this, declaring I would not be treated as a mere female. He then called her a viper, a traitor who had betrayed him. It was not the first time that high-minded statements of freedom and individualism would clash with personal ambition and jealousy. So this fellow Most is talking about how everyone should be free, and yet he wanted to control her. But one thing Emma had learned was that the spoken word, if hurled forth with eloquence, enthusiasm, and fire, could never be erased from the human soul. Another point of disagreement between Emma and some of her male colleagues was her insistence on joy and beauty in life. As the song says, she wanted bread and roses. What was the point of individual freedom if one could not have music, dancing, art, and flowers? She was called a rabid female agitator as she became well known. J. Edgar Hoover, in his early times, called her the most dangerous woman in America. The next big labor dispute was the homestead strike against Carnegie Steel, whose chairman was Henry Frick. When strike breakers attacked and killed strikers, Emma and Sasha decided direct action against Frick was the only choice. The execution of this idea was a series of bungles. Sasha got some instructions on how to build a bomb, but when he tested this out ahead of time, it didn't work. So they decided he would get a gun and shoot Frick. Sasha insisted that Emma not go with him. She needed to stay away so she could tell the story, because he figured he'd probably get killed. They needed $20 to pay for the gun and a suit so that he could get into the office. So Emma had an idea. Why didn't she do what the other women did? She could sell her body. It was for a good cause. But even though she got some new clothes and joined other streetwalkers, she was a total failure. She didn't know the wiles or attitudes to take. She was incredibly lucky. One man took her to a bar, advised her to give up her attempt, saying, you haven't got the knack. He gave her $10 and she got the rest from her sister. So Sasha went to Frick's office with a gun, a dagger, and a dynamite capsule. He shot Frick but missed his head. Frick fell, but when he was still moving and Sasha said, not dead, he tried to stab him in the leg. Meanwhile, Frick's people overwhelmed him and a policeman rushed in, ready to shoot Sasha. But Frick said, leave him to the law, but let me see his face. Sasha had thought that Frick's underlings would be happy to see him killed and would rally to the anarchist side. That did not happen, of course. And not only that, the attack caused the general public to turn against anarchism. And even the homestead strikers, on whose behalf Sasha was acting, immediately repudiated the attack, saying, we did not sanction this at all. This is not what we wanted. Sasha's trial was a travesty, not helped by the fact that he didn't speak fluent English. He refused to hire a lawyer, since lawyers are part of the hated establishment. So at age 22, he was condemned to spend his next 22 years in prison. While organizing defense funds for him, Emma met a fellow anarchist named Edward Brady. Over her life, Emma was to fall passionately in love with multiple men, and he was the next. They organized 4,000 people in a march in Union Square in New York, where Emma proclaimed, demonstrate before the palaces of the rich. Demand work. If they do not give you work, demand bread. If they deny you both, take bread. It is your sacred right. Of course, the newspapers lapped this up and printed all the statements of Red Emma. So Emma was arrested for inciting to riot. But the police chief said we could drop the charges and even pay her a good sum if she would just pass him information about the activities of her groups. Emma was incensed. She threw a glass of water in his face and declared, I'll take prison for life, but no one will ever buy me. That same detective was the chief witness against her at her trial, and she was sentenced to 1 year in jail. As she was led away, she called to the journalist, don't write any more lies about me than you can help. And one reporter admiringly stated, you just can't squelch that kid. Emma was just 24 years old. So here's one thing about Emma. She not only had theoretical beliefs about equality and community, but she actually lived them. Because of her past work experience, she was put in charge of the sewing shop in the women's prison. She was told to get more work out of the women, but she refused. The women heard this and began to trust her. Surprisingly, she also won the confidence of the warden. When the prison matron, who was the only one not susceptible to Emma's ways, banished her to what they called the dungeon, a tiny, dark, solitary cell, Guards left the door open and gave her a chair, a blanket, and hot coffee. Now, the one reason she might not have been in favor with the matron was because of her religious views. That doesn't come up as much in my talk, but there's quite a bit in the Women Without Superstition book, which you have in your library. For instance, in the prison, the matron said, "Yes, I was called before the head matron. What religion?" she was asked. "None. I am an atheist." Atheism is prohibited here. You will have to go to church." I replied, "I would do nothing of the kind. I did not believe in anything the church stood for, and not being a hypocrite, I would not attend." And at other times, she said, "Have not all theists painted their deity as the good God of love and goodness? Yet after thousands of years of such preachments, the gods remain deaf to the agony of the human race. So why are these gods not helping people more?" she asked. And then she said, "The Christian religion and morality extols the glory of the hereafter, and therefore remains indifferent to the horrors of the earth. The poor are to own heaven, then the rich will go to hell. That may account for the desperate efforts of the rich to make hay while the sun shines, to get as much out of the earth as they can, to wallow in wealth and superfluity, to tighten their iron hold on the blessed slaves, to outrage them every minute of the day, for now is their time." So she was quite cynical about religion. And mainly, she did not like the idea that religion, like government, was going to tell people what to do. When Emma fell ill and was sent to the infirmary, she was so helpful to the other patients that the doctor asked her to stay on, taught her some rudiments of nursing, and helped her. She helped run the place. She even came back to help out after her year was up. In prison, she was permitted books and used her time to read literature, history, and philosophy, and improve her English. When Emma was released, she wondered how to support herself. Ed, who was her current lover, proposed to pay her way to Vienna, where she could study nursing and midwifery. Opportunities to study medicine for women were still very scarce in America. It was after this trip she began to give her speeches in English, and she talked about anarchism and social justice, but also birth control, sex, and marriage. She had become, so famous that she even had wealthy admirers. Two of them agreed to pay her way to the International Anarchist Conference in Paris and on to Switzerland to study medicine more intensively. Now, by this time, Emma had already broken with Ed. She fell in love with a Czech anarchist named Hippolyte Havel. At the anarchist conference, Emma found that even that group refused to let her read a speech on sexual freedom for women. Even the anarchists could not deal with that. Instead, she attended a neo-Malthusian conference. Now, Malthusians were worried about population growing too fast, and therefore they had information on birth control, which she was, and contraception, which she was very, which she learned. But when Emma's benefactors were asking why she hadn't gone on to the medical school, she replied, "Emma Goldman, the woman and her ideas are inseparable. She will not permit anybody to dictate to her. Keep your money." She returned home partly because she and some friends had been working on an escape plan to get Sasha out of prison, but it was discovered and he was punished by being put in solitary for over a year. Finally, a new warden released him and new laws passed that reduced his overall sentence. So at this point, he had 5 more years. When Emma was finally able to visit him, she was shocked at his appearance, thin, half blind, battered, and unable to converse after such a long time in solitary. She now realized their assassination attempt had been a mistake. She began to speak against the use of violence in the movement. But a supreme act of violence was soon to shock the nation and the anarchist movement. In 1901, a professed anarchist, and I believe the name is pronounced Leon Czolgosz, shot President McKinley. He claimed he was inspired by Emma Goldman. At the time, Emma was in St. Louis, so she hoped to stay away and evade the police who were looking for her. But what they did was they rounded up a number of her friends, including her current lover. So she went to turn herself in. She was interrogated for days, but she denied any connection. And eventually he declared she had not specifically spoken to him or instigated violence. He had been. So Emma was released after 15 days. She went back on tour, but police followed her everywhere. In 1903, Congress passed a bill, the Anarchist Exclusion Act, So some of this, maybe a few years ago, would have sounded like old-time stuff, but it's back. This legalized the deportation of alien anarchists. Anyone not born in the United States who advocated social change could be barred from entry or deported. And of course, anarchist was also a synonym to them for foreigner, especially these Eastern European, Southern European people. I don't think that the Norwegians got targeted, even the some of the Germans. So in Emma's case, this again sounds like something that would happen today. The government went to work researching the status of Emma's husband, Jacob, the one she wasn't married to for very long. But if they could prove that he wasn't totally illegal, then she would not be a legal citizen either and would be easier to get rid of her. Well, Emma took up work as a nurse at masseuse to support herself. And she decided to start a magazine named Mother Earth. It published articles and literature on diverse subjects and ran for 12 years, which is long for this type of publication. Her contribution to the first issue was an essay entitled The Tragedy of Women's Emancipation. So interestingly, she did not agree with women getting the vote. She felt like that was one of these arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic thing, that women were would just be buying into a corrupt and useless system. And they did not really understand what she was trying to do. She also felt that erotic love was very important, probably because she didn't have it in her first marriage, and motherhood, because of a childhood illness, she was unable to have children. And perhaps this was a blessing because she was so devoted to her work. In her speeches, Emma insisted that free love meant the end of jealousy and bitter breakups. But ironically, she suffered intensely from jealousy. She would write letters of passionate longing and righteous anger. She was about to enter her most dramatic affair with a fellow named Ben Reitman, known as the Hobo King. He was a voice for and doctor to the many itinerant laborers in the United States, but he was also a liar and a constant womanizer. He became her tour manager and her lover. But the government was still watching her. In 1916, she spent 15 days in jail for speaking about birth control. Now, she had an option to pay a fine, but she always said, that's for rich people. I'm going to do the time. Then she went right back to speaking and was arrested multiple times, but mostly got off. The positive side was all the publicity. Her speeches would be printed. The final straw for the U.S. government came as the country prepared for and entered World War I. Anarchists believed that war was nothing but a tool of government and capitalism, sacrificing working people on both sides. When President Wilson signed a conscription bill, Emma and Sasha, who was finally out of prison, organized the No Conscription League and advised young men on how to avoid the draft. Police began to arrest men just for attending their peace rallies. Finally, federal agents arrested Emma and Sasha, charging them with conspiracy to obstruct the draft. Sasha argued there was no conspiracy since they had been totally open in their objection to war and conscription. Their case was referred to a higher court, so they were temporarily free. But world events interfered, the Russian Revolution, and demonstrations by socialists and communists in the U.S. led to what was called the First Red Scare and the Attorney General Special Force, which later be called the FBI, socialist and communist movements, they needed to be got rid of. Topping the list of undesirables were Emma Goldman and Sasha Berkman, but they weren't alone. And some of us who may have been around in or just after the Joe McCarthy era, it was very similar. More than 3,000 people were arrested in 1919 and more in 1920. Teachers were fired. Textbooks were rewritten to remove any radical material. That never happens anymore, right? A socialist duly elected to Congress was denied his seat. Amid this furor, Emma and Sasha were rounded up and informed they were being deported. As they sailed out past the Statue of Liberty, Emma was sad to leave. In spite of all her criticism, she loved and believed in America. She was now 48 years old. One consolation was Emma and Sasha would be able to go to the new workers' paradise of the Soviet Union that they had been hearing so much about. That's what the American communists thought. But when, after a long journey, they arrived in Russia, they were shocked. The country was in ruins from the war. People were poor, cold, and hungry. Famine and disease were killing thousands. The czarist establishments, which had dozens of rankings of citizens, had been replaced not by equality, but by a new system with 34 different classes, each with specific food rations. There was actually more bureaucracy than before. Permits were needed for almost everything. The Americans had heard that prisons and the death penalty had been abolished, but there were prisoners and executions everywhere. Dissent was not tolerated, as it was counter-revolutionary. Finally, Emma and Sasha were able to get an interview with Lenin and share their concerns. Vivian Gornick recounts, Sasha asked about all the anarchists in jail. Lenin replied irritably, there are no anarchists in jail, only criminals. Emma asked about the lack of freedom of speech, and Lenin told her coldly that freedom of speech was a bourgeois luxury. The final break came when the Red Army brutally crushed a strike by sailors in Kronstadt. Emma and Sasha left Russia after 23 months. If they hadn't, they would probably have ended up in a Siberian labor camp, as Lenin condemned all anarchists as enemies. Emma immediately wrote a book entitled My Disillusionment with Russia, exposing the hypocrisy and suffering she had witnessed. To her dismay, communists in Europe and America refused to believe her and ostracized her. Multiple countries refused to take them in. They were too dangerous. Eventually, Emma was able to settle in England. She was able to tour Canada. She finally wrote her autobiography, and she had supporters who raised money for her to live on. In 1934, she was already warning of the danger of Hitler and new authoritarianism. Suddenly, she had a new project. The Spanish Civil War looked like the true People's Revolution. She took on the job for them of directing the anarchist publications and PR, and she thought she was finally seeing her ideals come true. But the anarchists had to join a coalition government. They were taken over by the communists and, of course, eventually defeated by rightist forces. Emma told her friends, I am more than ever determined that my life should end as it began, fighting. And in fact, she was on a tour in Canada in 1940 when she suffered a stroke and died soon after. Just months before, an admirer had told Emma, it was not what you did or said that helped me, but what you were. The mere fact of the existence of your spirit, which never gives in and fights on, no matter how thick is the darkness in the world, in our own little worlds. And in death, she was awarded a return to the United States. She was able to have honored her long-standing wish to be buried in the same Chicago cemetery that contained the Haymarket martyrs who had inspired her extraordinary life. So that's a lot of information. If you have comments or questions for a few minutes here. Fritz always asks if I have a reading, and I always feel like I have too much information as it is. So I have mixed feelings about her too, that I don't, and I think that's true of many geniuses and reformers, that they can be very difficult people to deal with or live with, or they're so passionate about this, and they often will run over people in their ideals. Oh no, she was in Paris. She was in Paris some of the time. That's true. So I didn't focus very much on that part, but because that would have been in the 20s when there was that group there. She did not live there. She did live in France for quite a while. It was Peggy Guggenheim, who was from a rich family, the ones that have a museum named after them, was a supporter of hers and paid for her to live in France. So that's kind of an unusual type of sponsorship. So yes, Carl has written about his experiences, and there was definitely the same vibe. And therefore, there are several books, some of the biographies about Emma Goldman were written by women in the 70s, as was being rediscovered how relevant she was for the era. Part of it was that the Jews were oppressed. It does go into in her autobiography and so on how restricted they were in Russia, that they were not able to perform certain trades, they were not able to live in certain places, that sort of thing. And there was also a story of her seeing a peasant being badly beaten with some kind of horrible whip when she was young, and how wrong that was, that the landowner could treat the serfs like this, but within, and then of course the Jewish man is supposed to every morning thank God that he was not born a woman. So I don't know that her family was particularly religious, but that was definitely the culture. And these folks who met at Saks Cafe in New York. Yes, they were a lot of Jews from Russia and other areas that valued education and reformism.
So scary.
Demonization of somebody from Syria did something bad, so all Syrians are now questioned. And although I don't think they're questioning all the Portuguese after this other fellow, but yes, it's unless you're a white South African, so yeah, some of it's more relevant than we want. And yes, and she was very young. That's the other thing. When they had this crazy idea of assassinating somebody, and when you think about University of Wisconsin, the bombing at the building, and there was certainly things that people did in their youth that they later came to regret, even if they were not punished for them directly. I think that it was easier to make these grand pronouncements and do these possibly violent things when you're 21 years old. All right, thank you, everyone. And I do have a brief closing words. You might have seen this on a t-shirt back in the 1970s that I didn't realize came from Emma Goldman. If I can't dance, I don't want to be in your revolution.